everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show planned for all of you. My guest will be Anne Biclay, who is co-author of this great new book called The Hidden Half of Nature. And we'll tell you about that a little bit more in just a bit. But first, I want to go over some things in the news and some things that I'm sure you want to participate in and sign up for. And, of course, share my weekly recipe for you. So, for starters, we've had a busy week with things going on in politics. It's never a dull moment these days with this ongoing reality show that we have right in our capital city. It's just amazing to watch it all unfold. Sunday night I watched Comey on ABC, 60 Minute, I think it was, and or 2020, one of those shows. And it's just amazing that we still have this person in the White House that is as corrupt and dishonest as we do. So it will be an ongoing drama that we are going to all continue to watch. But meanwhile, what we do need to do is we all need to band together and be strong and fight for our environment, which he clearly is doing everything he can in his power to support businesses and corporations that will make money off of degrading our environment and polluting it some more. And so we need to all really band together. If you live in New York, there's a big, big event happening next Monday, the day after Earth Day, which is Sunday the 22nd. So on Monday, April 23rd, there's buses from all around New York heading up to Albany to make a statement to Governor Cuomo that we want him to really do more and be a leader when it comes to climate change. We were all so excited when he banned fracking in New York State. However, many years later, he is importing wasted fracking water and de-icing the streets with it. He is allowing the fracked gas to be transported through New York State in railroad cars and pipelines. 2 years ago, he promised us a risk assessment report on the dangers of having a pipeline, a big pipeline, right next to the Indian power plant, which I don't even think you need to really do a risk assessment. You can just think, look historically at things that have happened and see that it is a bad idea to put a gas pipeline right next to a Indian Point power plant. So we need to push him for these things and have him, you know, really stand up to the things he says. We need him to walk the talk that he's doing. He's good at talking the talk, but we need him to walk the talk. So I hope you will join me up in Albany on Monday. If you are on a Long Island bus, I actually will feed you. I'm going to make some food and share that with the bus. I love to do that for everybody. So please, you know, let me know if you're going to be on the bus. I hope to see you there because it's really going to be exciting. This time of year, I also love to share with everybody some of my favorite websites that will help you navigate the best foods to buy for your family, what produce is the most toxic, what produce to avoid. The Environmental Working Group has some unbelievably great lists. They, you know, talk about the best water filters, what veggies have the most pesticide residue, what fruits are the best to eat. They even go into sunscreen, what sunscreens are most toxic. You know, people don't think about our skin as a organ, but our skin is our largest organ. When we cover it with toxic sunscreen, especially on our children, we're really not doing them a service. You know, which is worse, the rays from the sun or this toxic lotion that you're putting on them? So you do have other choices, and it's really great to know. So the Environmental Working Group is one. Cornucopia Institute is another wonderful website that has lots of information. They rate dairy farms. As we know, all organic eggs are not created equal. You know, they will say that eggs are pasture raised, but are the eggs really, I'm sorry, are the chickens really living out in pasture, or are they just being allowed out for a moment? Do they have room to move? Are they being fed organic feed, or are they being fed the regular GMO feed, in which case, if they are eating GMO products, you're eating GMO products. So all important to know, and these lists really share that with you. Also, last week I was very disappointed to hear that the USDA has once again approved carrageenan in our organic products. And this is a natural product that is actually derived from seaweed, but it has been found to be carcinogenic and really a very unhealthy additive into our food, and has been banned in many foods in the EU, but not in this country. And there actually was reports that came out recently that, you know, really linked it to cancer and inflammatory conditions and really bad things, and yet the USDA decided to not listen to the Organic Standards Board and to go ahead and approve it again. So we have work to do. We also have work to do with the Farm Bill, which is coming up, and there's so many different issues revolving around the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill does not only determine what foods we're getting and are going to see in our supermarket, but it also is in charge of the SNAP program, which is a supplemental nutrition assistance program, also used to be called food stamps. And so many people depend on these services, and of course they're looking to cut it or make it contingent on a certain amount of work. And, you know, there's already that kind of restrictions in the program as it is, but they're just looking to make it harder and harder for people who are in need to really get this assistance. And most of these people that are on SNAP, studies have shown, are working. These are not lazy people that are not working, which is, of course, what our government would like us to believe. These are people that are working really hard and just can't make ends meet on the substandard salary that they're being paid. So please, you know, keep your eyes open for the Farm Bill if you have chances to support the Farm Bill. On my website, I certainly list some of the things that are being discussed in the Farm Bill and ways that you can get involved. So please consider doing that. Lots of things are coming up that you may want to know about. Actually, today, after this show, at Hofstra University, there is a conference going on called Long Island Food Coalition Conference. It's the State of Long Island Local Suburban Agriculture and Where Do We Grow From Here. And Mark Winnie, who was the keynote speaker, will be the keynote speaker, and he was a guest on my radio show a few weeks ago, and he wrote the book Stand Together or Starve Alone. And it's really, you know, discussing the need for us all to work together. And that's what I keep talking about. As community, we need to come together. We need to fight these big corporations and institutions that are trying to turn everything around, and we need to push forward to come together and find the common ground in all of our issues and really gain traction. And right now, there's so many individual grassroots organizations. Many of them are really pushing for the same things, but everyone's working separate, having to go out there trying to find our own separate funds, finding our own separate volunteers, having our own separate marches. And we really need to figure out ways to work together. So I'm really excited to hear Mark Winnie's talk and participate in some of the panels. Also, tonight there is a screening of a film called Before the Flood, and that's being shown at the Half Hollow Hills Community Library. And there will also be a discussion beforehand and after, and the Climate Reality Project is sponsoring this event. April 21st, there's a forum taking place out at the St. Francis Episcopal Church, Growing to Give Forum. And this is a forum for gardeners, both for beginning or advanced gardeners, to strengthen your skills and to really be a catalyst for personal and community transformation. And Brian Sellers Peterson, author of Harvesting Abundance, will be the keynote speaker for that. Also, Beyond Organic is having a Fundamentals of Permaculture on April 21st, at the Earth Arts Initiative in Brooklyn, and that's from 4 to 7 p.m. On Saturday. And it's only $15. So if you're interested in permaculture, that's really a wonderful thing to check out. Earth Day, the Peconic Land Trust is having a celebration. They're going to do an Earth Day trail walk with at the Ruth Olivia Preserve at Dam Pond, which is out east in East Marion on Long Island. Also coming up is Long Island Restaurant Week from April 22nd to the 29th. So if there's restaurants you've been vying to try, this is a good time to take advantage of that. Earth Day is also being celebrated at the New York Society of Ethical Culture, and they will be having Adrian Hyde as their guest speaker talking about regenerative agriculture. He's the owner of Dunwell Farm in, it's a certified organic vegetable farm in Hopewell, New Jersey. And then, as I said, there's going to be the rally to Albany on April 23rd. On April 24th, there's a great film screening that I'm going to try to make it to, being funded by the Hunter College Sustainable Program. And it's a screening of James Beard, America's First Foodie. And there's the whole James Beard Foundation in New York. They're, you know, really doing a lot of great work to bring food consciousness to the public. And he really was one of the first foodies. So that should be an interesting film. They'll be serving refreshments. And I believe it's free and worth checking out. Oh, there's so many things. Of course, there's the Sheep Shearing Festival up at Stone Barns. I'm told it's sold out, but I don't know if you show up, whether you can get in or not. And I have a lot of other things on my website, so I don't want to take any more time and go over them, but you should go to my website at IE Green and look at all the different events going on. There's another screening I should just mention on April 30th called Farmers for America, and that's supposed to be a great documentary film about farmers and how farmers are aging out in this country and what we need to do to help promote farming in our country so that we can feed everybody. So that should be a really good film and discussion. So I'd like to share with all of you now my recipe. I did one version of this last month. It's a Mediterranean pasta dish. When I first shared it with you, I did the vegan version, and I made it again. This time, excuse me, I had company over who were not vegan and, and I wanted to make a whole casserole that I could bake in the oven ahead of time. So I added some feta cheese and some mozzarella cheese to it and some Parmesan cheese and, and it was delicious. So this dish, you use 1 pound of pasta, and you can use whatever kind of pasta you like, a penne, I used a cavatelli, some olive oil, a bunch of broccoli, 1 onion chopped, 1 carrot sliced into small julienne strips, 1 celery chopped, 4 mushrooms chopped, 1 cup of bok choy, 3 tablespoons of chopped garlic, 1 can of chickpeas, 2 teaspoons of fresh thyme, the leaves you remove from the stem and then you chop them, 2 teaspoons of fresh sage that you chop, 1 teaspoon of dried oregano, 1 can of fire-roasted tomatoes with chilies. If you just have regular fire-roasted tomatoes, you can add some red pepper flakes if you'd like, or leave that out if you don't like spicy food. 1/2 cup of hot, whole, sweet picante peppers. That was approximately 20 of those little peppers that come in the jar. 1 cup of Kalamata olives and 1/4 cup of fresh Italian parsley. And like I say with all of my recipes, when you're the chef, you get to pick what vegetables you put into your dishes. If there's a vegetable on here that you don't have, it doesn't mean you can't make it. Just add something else or switch things around. It's, you know, my recipes are always very flexible so that you can accommodate what you have in your refrigerator to make the recipe. So you're going to cook the pasta according to their directions, and you want to cook it on the al dente side because it is going to also bake in the oven. And meanwhile, in a large wok, you can put a little olive oil in the bottom, and you're going to add some onions. And when they become translucent, after about 5 minutes, you can add the carrots, the celery, and the garlic. Then you cook that for about 5 more minutes. Then you can add the mushrooms, then the broccoli, then the bok choy. And basically, you're adding the vegetables in the order of how long they take to cook. So if you don't know that, you can use the recipe. But if you do have an idea of how long different vegetables take to cook, you always start with the root vegetables because they take the longest, and then you move up to the leafy greens, which usually take the least amount of time. Then I added, you can either add a little more olive oil if you need to, if it's starting to stick at the bottom, or you can add a little water, which also will help deglaze the pan and allow you to continue stir-frying without adding more oil. Then I added the fire-roasted tomatoes with the chili, the chickpeas, the olives, the sweet peppers, and half of the parsley. I also added salt and pepper to taste. You know, trying to use less salt in my dishes these days, but salt definitely brings out a lot of the flavor, so you just adjust it according to what you like. Once that's all together, you spray the bottom of a casserole pan, pour all of the, you add the pasta, of course, to the wok, and then pour all of that into a casserole pan. You can crumble the feta cheese on top, then spread over the grated mozzarella cheese and just sprinkle with a little bit of the Parmesan cheese. So I used 1 cup of crumbled feta, 1 cup of grated mozzarella cheese, and 2 tablespoons of Parmesan cheese. And then I baked it in the oven for about 15 minutes at 350 degrees, just really till the cheese is melted and till it starts getting a little golden brown around the edges. And then sprinkle the top with the remaining parsley so it looks beautiful, and that's it. And enjoy. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week. Anne Biclay is the author or co-author of The Hidden Half of Nature, which she co-wrote with her husband, David Montgomery. And he'll be a guest on my show in a couple of weeks, and we'll be talking about this book and another book he wrote as well, or a couple other books he wrote. But Anne is a biologist with a wide-ranging interest in watershed restoration, environmental planning, and public health. She co-authored this book, and this book is great because it's really exploring the parallels between garden health and our gut health. She's often an invited speaker at universities and national conferences on the connection between public health and the built and natural environments. And she's worked extensively with community groups and nonprofit organizations on environmental stewardship and urban livability projects. And Anne just loves spending her time outside in the garden with her hands on plants and in the dirt. And Anne, I'm so happy to have you with me. Are you there?
Yeah. Thank you, Bhavani.
You're so welcome. So before we get started and get into the nitty-gritty of your beautiful book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, sure. I'll just add a little bit there to my bio and
sure.
Tell folks. I think since I've been a kid, the world outside of the house, wherever I've lived, has always been, to my mind, just far more interesting than what is going on inside of the house. And I'm not a kid who grew up in the country or anything like that. I grew up in the suburbs of Denver, and then went to college in Northern California, Santa Cruz and Berkeley, and that only further sort of opened my eyes to the natural world and uh-huh. what it is that we have around us. And I have to say, sort of what got me moving toward the hidden half of nature, and if I'm sure you have gardeners and plant lovers that are listening, and they will thoroughly relate to this, but I never quite expected that a bad case of plant lust would lead to writing a book, The Hidden Half of Nature. But it was sort of my fascination with plants and the natural world that got this book going. And my formal training is in biology, more toward the natural history end of things than, say, molecular and cellular biology. But in the course of writing The Hidden Half, I definitely got in touch with some of the tiniest creatures on Earth and some of the intricacies and processes that go on inside of the cells that make up our body. And Yeah, so that's a bit about who I am now. I'm now pretty much turned away from a career of, you know, going to an office and dealing with environmental and land use issues and the complexity of human beings and so on, and now turned full-time writer. And what I really love is writing and thinking and communicating about the ways in which our natural and physical world actually work and what that has to do with our well-being and our potential to do more and to do better by this planet is sort of what I'm really into these days.
Well, good. We need more people that want to share that knowledge with everyone, because there's so many others that are inside, that are in front of a screen all day long and don't venture outside. I mean, some of the statistics I've been hearing of how much outdoor time children get, for instance, it's astonishing. I mean, they just, you know, you open a door and tell a kid to go out and play, and they look at you and, like, they don't know where to start. Like, how do you play outside? They don't even know sometimes. So, you know, this book and, you know, just this concept is so needed.
Yeah.
So needed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you give us a little overview of the book?
Thank you. So it's funny. This book started so close to home. It started right out in the backyard, as a matter of fact. My husband David and I, we live in Seattle on a standard-sized city lot in Seattle. And part of what attracted us to the house, you know, years ago was that there was a large side yard, and by large I mean, oh, maybe 30 or so feet wide by about 100 feet deep. And there was nothing but old growth lawn growing in that side yard. And I had gardened off and on ever since I was a kid, but never had lived anywhere long enough to really, you know, put down roots, so to speak, and think about something as sort of humbling and awe-inspiring as planting a tree and watching it grow. Because I was always, you know, moving on after, you know, 12 or 18 months moving around for school and stuff like that. So my mind just went, oh my God, this is like a blank slate. I can, because I'm really the gardener in the family. My husband isn't. I recruit him for certain things, and he's always a very good sport about that. But I was the one who was dreaming and scheming. And so as it turned out, what we decided to do was, okay, we really want literally a blank slate. So we're going to demolish everything on the lot except for the house. We're going to get rid of that old growth lawn. We had a couple of poor trees that had been had been cut back probably no less than 99 times, and they just, you know, they looked like some kind of crazy Medusa head thing. It was just, the whole thing was awful. So we scraped everything off of the lot, and we were left with dead dirt, because we had never, in Seattle, there is, something is growing everywhere. It's pretty unusual to see bare soil, but when I took a look at our bare soil, anyone who's seen us give talks could also see that soil. It was, about the color of a pair of khaki pants, and there were rocks of all sizes everywhere, from, you know, something the size of, you know, half a wheelbarrow to small pebbles, just everywhere. And this had to do in large part with the glacial history of Seattle, because we were once overrun by glaciers, and it created this soil. But I had all of these plants sitting around in pots. It was the middle of August, and contrary to what most people think, August can get brutally hot in Seattle. And I thought, what am I going to do? There is, this soil looks dead. I'm going to be running up our water bill once I do get them in the ground. And I frankly just sort of panicked, because it was sort of, I had dreamed and schemed for several years, Bhavani, and all of a sudden I thought, oh my God, this is all going to come crashing down on us. How could this have happened? you know, this was terribly embarrassing for myself as a biologist that we had not kind of taken soil samples, and in part we got caught in this bind of planting things in August because of our landscape contractor person. But then my husband, who is a geologist, I thought, well, you should have been looking at the soil, dear husband. And so I panicked, and I began to think, my gut said organic matter. I'd gardened enough, and I'd seen the results of adding organic matter to small, tiny little gardens I had before, and I thought, that's where you're going to start, and then let's see where things go from there. And so I began what I call my sort of organic matter chronicles, and I began collecting everything cheap or free that I could lay my hands on that was close by in my neighborhood. And so that ranged from coffee grounds at the local coffee shop, wood chips that I was able to secure for free from arborists once the fall came around, dead leaves from all my neighbors' trees. And I began making, I love the way you describe your casserole, because that is exactly how I approach making my mulches. I collect, I have on hand at any one time different types of organic matter that I've collected. It's usually my base, like your pasta there, my equivalent in a mulch would probably be my wood chips. And it is to the wood chips that I add other things. I have some finished compost. I scored this fabulous leaf mold from a farmer way north of Seattle. And so those are just, so I mix all of these things together. And what I began doing in the garden was laying these mulches on top. I was not digging anything in, partly because I had no time to be digging things in, and I just wanted to get the soil covered up, because the thought, you know, Dave wrote this book about erosion, and I'm like, oh my God, this is even more embarrassing than where we are now. It's like I've got this bare soil, and I know, you know, what potentially could happen. This could erode off. So the long and the short of it is, this soil restoration project to build and have a garden and greenery around us led to asking questions of what is really going on beneath our feet in the soil. And that led to a fascinating, burgeoning field of science about microbiomes. And a microbiome is what before we just used to call microbiota. People are familiar with probably one of the most common types of microorganisms, which is bacteria. But in addition to bacteria, what also are other members of the microbiome are fungi, even viruses, and viruses which are an oddity in the biological world because they're not really considered alive, but they're a big member in the soil microbiome. And then there's also tons and tons of other kinds of life forms in the soil that were decomposing all of these mulches that I had laid on top of the beds. And when we looked into the science of all of this, it was really, really fascinating, because what we learned, Bhavani, is that I thought I was feeding my plants, right? I'm this person with a bad case of plant lust, trying to keep these plants alive. And in the end, as it turned out, what we were doing is we were feeding the plant microbiome, and specifically the portion of the plant microbiome that lives around the roots of the roots of soil. And this became just a topic of unceasing fascination, interest, and importance, because you sort of combine sort of our modern science with what folks were doing, you know, way back in time, and microbiomes and what they do in the soil and, in fact, in our own bodies are this marriage of some forms of ancient wisdom with, you know, modern technology and science. So the book is really, it's a sort of a personal memoir blended with history and science that we hope readers by the end will see, you know, why it is so important that we examine both our agricultural practices and our medical practices, because we're not kind to microbiomes, and we do not always practice great stewardship when it comes to microbiomes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So you're talking about the things that you really can't see. You're not talking about the worms and the, you know, all the life that you see if you look under a microscope. You're looking at, you're talking about things that you don't see, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the microbiome is it's all of the microorganisms. They are invisible to the human eye, and in fact, actually, they're the things that you do need some kind of magnification microscope or even more powerful forms to see. They're typically, you know, one-celled life forms. You know, compared to us, we've got we're, you know, multicellular life forms, and these are the tiniest creatures on Earth. I think that's probably the most basic, simple way that people can think about what is a microbiome. These are literally the tiniest creatures on Earth, out of view, unless we have magnification to see them. Yeah, and fungi mm-hmm. are interesting because people think of a mushroom. It's like, well, wait a minute, I can see a mushroom. Well, what is interesting about mushrooms that makes them a part of the microbial world, or fungi, I should say, that makes them a part of the microbial world, is the compartments between their cells are not completely sealed off from one another. So in essence, they are a single-celled organism. It's just that that cell happens to be quite large, and the above-ground part is visible to us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what would you say are some of the key things that gardeners and farmers should know about the microbial part of the plant that's in their garden?
Yeah. The key thing about that is that we all look at a plant, and even me, as much as I've looked at plants and grown and cultivated and killed a few, I will say, plants, is we look at them, and because they don't move around, it's sort of hard to get the plant's eye view of life. But they are actually, plants are as sort of complex and they have their own life strategy for how they're going to live on this planet. And they have developed some grand symbiotic relationships with the life of the soil, with their microbiome. And the symbioses revolve around, this is not, shouldn't really be a surprise to people, it revolves around basically food. And that food, it's a two-way street. Plants pump a great number of compounds and molecules out of their roots. So we think of roots sometimes, you know, as a one-way directional thing, that plants are sucking things out of the soil. But in fact, plants are exuding. The term for all of these compounds is exudates. So they're pouring out of, if your plant is healthy, that is, they're pumping exudates out in the soil because this is food for their microbiome. So you can sort of picture it. I often talk about it as there's a plant's root system is really like sort of a smorgasbord for microorganisms. And there they are. Bacteria and fungi just cloaking and swathing the roots of plants. And some bacteria and fungi actually live inside of a plant's roots. They're intimately connected to the way that a plant's green body works. So our microorganisms are you know, slurping, chewing, not really, but just to get the idea across, mm-hmm. slurping and chewing and swallowing, and they're bringing these plant exudates into their body. And these plant exudates are many of the same things that we eat. They're carbohydrates, they're proteins, and recently it was learned even fats is what the microbiome is eating. And in return, the plant, a plant will put a good amount of its energy that it's taken in through photosynthesis, up to 40% of that, into turning that stuff into food for the microorganisms that are a part of its microbiome. And that's a big expenditure. That's like you taking your casserole and you know, saying, okay, we're getting half here, you know, yourself and your guests. The other half is I'm going to put out on the sidewalk, and we'll just see who comes to get that. I mean, that's a lot of work to go to, right?
Right, right.
But so these microorganisms, they're giving something back in exchange for getting these exudates. And
These are metabolites and compounds that the plant itself either cannot make or cannot easily get. And one thing that bacteria will give back to plants is hormones that spur and activate plant growth. So this is pretty amazing that bacteria in the soil are producing growth hormones for the plants on whose roots they are living. That's something
right.
else. The other thing is that fungi can greatly, people have heard of mycorrhizal fungi, some of your listeners, I'm sure, and these are type of fungi that at one end they are associating with the plant's roots, and clear far, far away from where the plant's roots go, that's where the fungi are going, and they are able to mine very important nutrients out of the soil, directly out of rocks, too, that they bring back to the plant. And one of those things is phosphorus. And that, anyone who's ever purchased a bag of fertilizer will see NPK on the front part of the fertilizer bag, and P is the phosphorus part of that. And so you don't need to buy a bag of fertilizer, because if you have robust and abundant populations of the right kinds of fungi, they will go around in the soil and collect that stuff and bring it back to your plant. And so this is what gardeners and farmers need to know, is that you can grow the biology in your soil to form these symbiotic relationships with your crops or with your vegetables or with, in my case, I've got a number of trees. And so it's like I really want to make sure that my microbes, my microbial herds, because that's how I envision it. I've got herds of microbes in the soil that are doing the work of feeding my plants. And that's what farmers and gardeners really need to know, is if you grow the biology, you can grow your plant.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's part of why there's such robust discussion right now about hydroponics being able to be called organic versus growing in the soil. Because if you don't have soil feeding the plants, you know, organic farmers truly believe that something is missing.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
That's right. Right. That's become very controversial. And to my mind, it's very troubling to me, in part because of everything we are learning about the connections between a plant's well-being and its health and all of these exchanges that go on between its microbiome and its root system. And I haven't looked into hydroponics deeply enough to understand or learn, well, what kinds of metabolites, what kind of bacterial metabolites is a plant missing out on when it's grown hydroponically? And if those metabolites are missing in the plant's green body, what does that mean for, you know, obviously if you're growing edible plants, what does that mean for the nutrient quality of the plants? I mean, what's often found between conventional and organic agriculture is that if you were just to analyze, you know, organic and conventional apples, let's say, what you generally find is that apples being mostly carbohydrate, you generally find that the carbohydrate level is about the same between organic and conventional. But what is different are the group of nutrients that we don't really need to put on biomass, that is, to grow and develop normally. But the nutrients that are different between those two things are the phytochemicals and vitamins and mineral levels, which those are the things that our body doesn't use so much to grow, but it definitely uses those things to, as part of sort of the human biology of preventing and fending off diseases. So what I wonder about hydroponics is, I'll bet you know, you're getting carbohydrate, protein, and fat content about the same in whatever it is you're growing hydroponically, but what about these group of nutrients that we know are incredibly important for disease prevention and well-being of not just our physical body, but, you know, also our mental health. And I haven't seen studies, and but I this has been something I really have been interested in looking into because I wonder about that.
Mm-hmm.
I really wonder about that. Obviously, some plants, their normal habitat is an aquatic environment, right? Kelp, right, in the mm-hmm. ocean, or plants that are growing in freshwater environments. But a tomato, a tomato is just not an aquatic plant.
Right.
It's not adapted to be one. And so, yeah, it's very interesting.
Well, yeah, and you know that, you know, what a living organism eats affects its health, whether it's, you know, a mom, a pregnant woman, you know, feeding her baby, or the fish in the ocean, you know, the fish that are wild in the ocean eating plankton and kelp and the natural things that they find in the ocean versus being fed fish pellets that are made from chicken scraps, you know, there's going to be a difference in the nutritional quality of that product. So,
right.
Very, very interesting. Anyway, Ann, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about the second half of the book where you really make that connection between food, diet, and the health and the aftermath of cancer, et cetera. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Ann Bickley, author of The Hidden Half of Nature, and we'll be right back.
Yeah, I'm not known as a gadget guy, but I love gadgets that really do the trick, like the new app. The Progressive Radio Network has an app, thanks to our friends at Audio Now. Hey, this is Mark Farrell, host of Insight on Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we broadcast live out of New York City. But if you can't catch the show live, no frets. It's always archived. It's always on the app. Download it now, listen later, whenever you want. The Progressive Radio Network app is available from our friends at Audio Now. Check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm with my guest, Ann Bickley, co-author of The Hidden Half of Nature. And we were just talking about her book, and it's a wonderful, wonderful overview of the microbial roots living in the soil. And, you know, in the second half of your book, you really got a little bit more into food and diet and how it affects your health. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned there and share that with us?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so in the second part of the book, I share with readers my experience with cancer diagnosis and with sort of moving forward with my life and healing in the aftermath of all of that. And that event in my life struck right actually as we were writing The Hidden Half of Nature. And I began to have, partly as a result of researching the human microbiome and because of my personal health experience, I realized that I really didn't know all that much about my immune system. And in my case, I had a big, big question. I wondered, why had my immune system sort of failed on me? Why had it not caught, you know, these first abnormal cells that were probably not a problem, but then they very much became a problem when my immune system did not do what it was supposed to do, which was find those abnormal cells, destroy them, and keep things that way. Mm-hmm. And so I began doing a lot of research into the human immune system and also looking at how diet affects our health and our well-being. And one of the things I realized, you know, so I live in Seattle, and this is an urban area where, in theory, I should be eating, you know, healthy food, food that's grown in soil that itself is healthy. And while I really was never a junk food eater, let's say, and neither was Dave, I realized that what was really kind of short in our diet was vegetables. And what's interesting about that is that I started to ask myself, well, how is this? You live in a state that has nearly year-round growing potential, and there's farmers markets around, there's decent grocery stores around. And when it came right down to it, I thought, you know, part of this is it's even hard for someone as educated and mindful as I am when it comes to seeking out and eating healthfully, that there's just sort of such an abundance of food around us in the Western world, and especially in a place like Seattle. And it becomes difficult to navigate, you know, sort of not just mainstream marketing of food and ultra-processed food, but I've been finding at my local farmers markets, and it's even more so now than several years ago, that all kinds of prepared foods are kind of sneaking in, and I realized that what I had been doing is sure I was eating stuff from the farmers market, but it was like, lots of maybe types of bread that was sort of hollowed out of nutrients. It was meat, maybe more meat than maybe I should have been eating. And I thought, all those foods taste great. And in a lot of cases, you know, it's not as though I was eating KFO beef or something like that. But I thought, what's happening is that sort of the grains and the meats of my diet are shoving the vegetables off the side of the plate. Let's get things rebalanced here. And at the time, I was also seeing a naturopath for healing from surgery that I had for cancer. And the more I talked with her, the more I realized, oh my God, I'm just missing out on the, for a person like me who's as much in love with the botanical world as I am, I have not quite taken this to heart in my diet. There's such a variety of plant foods out there for us to eat. And this sounds crazy, Bhavani, but I just started eating. You know, I'm a pretty good cook, and so cooking was not a barrier for me. And I just decided, like, okay, well, we're going to start eating more vegetables. So what that means is, okay, more vegetables on the plate. And if there's more vegetables on the plate, then there's a little bit less meat on the plate, and there's, you know, maybe less in the way of, something like, you know, pasta. And so when I started putting more vegetables on our plate, I realized, oh, my God, there's so many different tastes in these vegetables. They can be combined, actually, with pasta, with meat. It's just, let's go heavy on the vegetables and let's go lighter on the meat and lighter on the pasta. Mm-hmm. I really liked your pasta recipe because you were talking about all those vegetables in the pasta. And so I try to stay, so that was sort of my epiphany, as I'm sitting here in this food mecca, but I was not fully taking advantage of everything that was there. And Now that I do that, it's funny, it was a little tough over this winter to keep the vegetables on the plate, but I have to say we're really coming into spring now, and I'm looking out at my garden, and I have this fantastic perennial arugula that looks like a mop head of green out there right now, and I've been going out there daily like a rabbit, snipping off pieces of that to bring in and mix with other greens for salads.
Uh-huh.
And so I think part of what I also did at that time is I started growing more vegetables in the garden, right? And your listeners know this, you know this. There just is nothing that can pick the taste and flavor of something that you have just picked out of your own garden.
I know. And isn't it amazing? The arugula you grow is probably like a whole different thing than the arugula you buy in a bag.
Oh yeah, I can't even buy arugula in a bag anymore, and I can't do it because what's in my mind is the arugula that I grow, and I'm like, don't do it. You're going to be really disappointed. Really disappointed.
Well, no, what it's so hard for me also when I go out to a restaurant, which I don't do that often. People are always asking me for restaurant recommendations, and it's like, I really don't eat at many restaurants. You know, I'll go to one time to meet people, and then sometimes someone will say, let's try another one, I'll go to another one. But I don't frequent a regular restaurant. And partly it's like, is because I want to get a salad, and the salads can't compare to the salad I'm going to make myself at home. So
yeah,
it's really hard.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so in the book, you know, and I think we all know this in our heart of hearts and our stomach of stomachs, that what you want a balance of things on your plate. I'm not like saying don't ever eat meat and don't ever eat wheat and don't ever eat pasta. What I'm saying is picture your plate in front of you, and you want an abundance of vegetables on that plate.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have those be whatever you'd like. I mean, right, there are a lot of different plant foods out there. I liked how you talked about putting the chickpeas, you know, in your pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Because beans are a plant food. A fresh kale leaf is a plant food. A wheat grain is a plant food. And so you just incorporate these different forms of plants, and it's not that hard to get an abundance of vegetables on your plate. I mean, I can talk about that, you know, from personal experience, because once I started actually doing it instead of just thinking about it or wondering how would I do that, I just started doing it. And it's a little bit like anything, starting is the hardest part, but then you do it one day and then you do it a second day and then the third day you're like, oh, this is what I do now. I put an abundance of vegetables on my plate.
Uh-huh.
There's no like hemming and hawing. There's no, oh, you know, maybe this, maybe that. And one of the other things I did was sort of my whole epiphany about the foods that I ate at the time is that I think we all have sugar is a very pleasurable thing. And I realized that amongst the wonderful, wonderful kinds of foods in Seattle, there's a lot of sugar. We have some phenomenal bakeries, as I'm sure you do, where you live and where the places that your other listeners live. Phenomenal bakeries. I mean, so it's not like I'm in a store buying packs of Oreos. It's like, ooh, I'm going to go to Macrina Bakery and get their, you know, XYZ. And I thought, let's evaluate, like, exactly how many bakeries and how frequently are you going
right
to these places? And I thought, well, it's not like you can't go to a bakery, but why don't you try a new habit? Like, try just on Wednesdays. You could go and get whatever your favorite thing is at that bakery. And what was so interesting is that once I pick Wednesday was the bakery day, so I'd really look forward to Wednesday, and I'm like, okay. And I'd go there. And then it was really, really interesting because, like, the first maybe two or three or four times I'm like, oh, yeah, this is great. This is what I like. And then afterwards I thought, I don't know. What was so great about that? What was so great about that? And then, like, I forgot to go, like, on a Wednesday. And I realized, wow, this whole thing, I'd gotten into the habit of going, and I'd sort of stopped thinking, like, why am I mm-hmm. going? And so it's paying attention to your food patterns wherever you live, whether you live in a place like Seattle or somewhere that there is not maybe the variety and quality. You can always, I think, stop and examine and do something that is a little bit better than what you were doing, either, you know, a little or a lot better than what you were doing before. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you always hear also, at least I always hear, how sugar feeds cancer.
You know,
so of all the foods that you don't want to be eating or you really want to cut down is sugar if you're trying to rid your body of cancer. So.
Yeah. There's a lot of different kind of cancers and different biology on how they grow, but glucose is a, right? I mean, that's why we eat it. It's food for our brain, and it can feed growth. Yeah. So that mm-hmm. that was also in the back of my mind at this time.
Right.
Very much.
Right. And, you know, it always, not cracks me up, but I always, you know, roll my eyes when I have clients who say, oh, you know, no, the doctor told me I can't eat. They were doing radiation. I was making miso soup for them, and miso is supposed to be very good if you're undergoing radiation. And they're like, oh, no, my doctor said I can't eat soy. But meanwhile, they're eating donuts and sugar, and I'm thinking, you know, what's with the doctors? They, you know, soy is a bean, you know. They say, they're telling you not to eat soy, but they don't say anything about sugar.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting.
You know, yeah, I really wish current-day medical students would get more education in links between food and health and not just food, but like the actual, the quality of that food and how that food was grown, right? Because a long time ago, we didn't have chemotherapy and surgery and radiation and drugs. What we had was our body and what our body did with the food, and we now know that our microbiome has a huge influence on the impact of food on our body now because of what goes on in the gut. I mean, it's many things similar to what goes on around the roots of a plant with respect to its microbiome. Our microbiome produces a great number of compounds and molecules with medicinal effects that travel. Some stay in our gut, but some travel outside of our gut and affect our metabolism and our mental health. And so, you know, it sort of stand to reason based on that alone that you're paying attention to your diet is very important for, you know, maybe how you feel on that day, but it's important for your health down the road, years ahead.
Right, and you want to do it ahead of time so that you're not only doing it to try to cure yourself, but you're trying to prevent illness
exactly.
as well. So it's good to do it before. So we're just about out of time, but I know you've managed to boil your book down into a tagline that I'd like you to just share with my listening community before we sign off.
Sure, and for people who have been listening, I bet you some of them are onto this already. In talking about, you know, the health of plants and people and mulch and organic matter. But here's our six words. Mulch your soil inside and out. All right. There it is.
Good. Good. Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining me. It's been really fascinating. Your book is, you know, opened up a whole new world for me. And I am a gardener, so it's really, really fascinating. So thank you so much for your work.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
And
thank
I look
you,
forward to having your husband on in a few weeks.
Sure, yeah. And if anybody wants to sort of see more what we're up to and what kind of content we post on social media, Twitter, we're pretty active on Twitter, and that handle is at dig2grow, D-I-G, the number 2, grow, G-R-O-W. Thank you so much, Bhavani.
Perfect. You're welcome, and I'll share those links on my website, too, so people can find it there if they didn't get to write it down.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Anne, and thank you, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week. Bye for now.